You're listening to Panel Borders, Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and if you're a dedicated Sunday night listener of Resonance, tuning into this show for the first or second time, having not sampled it before on Thursday afternoons, welcome to the UK's only weekly radio show about comic books, graphic novels, and sequential art. This show has been running for 4 years, so if you enjoy what you hear tonight, please check out the back catalogue of the programme at www.panelborders.wordpress.com/index. Comics aren't just about superheroes or gag strips in the tabloids, although we cover those topics as well, but sequential art of all forms. From work that is self-published and put out by small independent companies, such as Nobrow Press, who printed one of tonight's interviewee's books, as well as more established publishers such as Jonathan Cape, an imprint of Random House, who printed the other graphic novel I'll be discussing tonight. Previous interviewees have included classic British cartoonists such as Raymond Briggs, Glenn Baxter and Gerald Scarfe, novelists who also work in comics, such as Neil Gaiman, Audrey Niffenegger and Philip Pullman, with work that covers the gamut from World Fantasy Award-winning short comics to strips serialised in The Guardian and elsewhere. If you're into superhero comics, due to the newfound renaissance of successful films in recent years, also in the archive you can find my interviews with the likes of Alan Moore and his collaborators such as Dave Gibbons, who drew Watchmen, David Lloyd, who drew V for Vendetta, and Eddie Campbell, who drew From Hell, which was turned into a woeful movie starring Johnny Depp, but still exists on the shelf as a terrific graphic novel exploring the mind of a 19th century serial killer. Hopefully tonight's interviews with a pair of 20-something creators will give you a taste for more. And if you tune into this show on forthcoming Sunday nights, guests on future editions include novelists China Mieville and Denise Mina, a series of shows looking at comic book creators around the country, with interviews recorded in their hometowns, which include a return visit by David Lloyd talking about Brighton, and 2000 AD artists Jock and Dom Reardon talking about Totnes. A forthcoming series of shows about genre include Neil Gaiman talking about examples of science fiction in his work, Jim Zubkovich talking about fantasy, and Tim Keeble and Andrew Cheverton talking about westerns. If you haven't worked it out by now, I like to theme each month around a specific topic, and another forthcoming month of shows will be all about the long-running American comic Hellblazer, which has been mainly penned by Brits, and examples of these talking on the subject include Andy Diggle, writer of The Losers, also turned into a movie in recent times, current scribe Peter Milligan, and the creator of the comic, Jamie Delano. Graphic novelist Ian Culbard will be joining a month of shows about H.P. Lovecraft in comics, alongside Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, and American iconoclastic comic book artists featured in forthcoming episodes include Klaus Janson, Tim Sale and David Collier. Tonight, however, continuing our month of shows about new British comics in a change to our advertised programme, a different version of which will hopefully broadcast later this month, I'm talking to a pair of young cartoonists who have, in my opinion, produced two of the finest new graphic novels to appear in the English language in 2011. Later in the show, I'm talking to Luke Pearson about his graphic novella Everything We Miss, a disturbing tale about ghostly creatures who inhabit people's bodies and make them act against their will, as well as other phantasmagoria just outside of our field of vision. First though, as with last week's show, in which Robin Warren spoke to Canadian cartoonist and DJ Kid Koala, I'm talking to an international cartoonist whose work has been published in the UK. So the first interview in this week's show is with French graphic novelist Bastien Vives, whose terrific book Le Goutte de Chlore was translated in English earlier this year by Jonathan Cape as A Taste of Chlorine. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Bastian Vives, author of A Taste of Chlorine. I was looking at your bibliography online, and I believe you've done about a dozen graphic novels in the past decade or so. For someone who's only 27, you seem to be very prolific.
Yes, I started young, at 21, 22 years old, when I was studying animation. And I have a lot of energy to put on comics, and now I'm a little more slow.
Okay. I believe A Taste of Chlorine is the only one of your books that's available in English so far.
Yes, it's the only one is published in English because it was it arrived in 2008 in France, and 3 years later we have the English version. I hope the next book that I have made can be translated in English in this year or after. We will see.
Do you have any ideas why, it's Jonathan Cape, why they approached you to publish this book in particular as the first example of your work in English?
Yeah, because these books in France have a little success. I have made other books before, but these books, and I don't know, the sale of these books are not very high.
Okay.
But there is a lot of translation of these books, and I don't know, in Korea, in Italia, or a lot of country, and maybe, I don't know, it's the editors have a coup de cœur. I don't know, how can I say in English, has just read the story and have this thing, okay, this book I like, and they print it, and they don't think that they have to sold it a lot, but it's, I don't know.
I mean, it's interesting to hear that you studied animation, because the depiction of the movements of swimming and the human beings moving through water, they do seem to be from the eye of someone who's used to seeing things moving rather than just drawing still images on the page. So doing a graphic novel like this, having studied animation before, did it make a lot easier to do a graphic novel where actually you have to get a sense of movement on the page?
Yeah, because the action took place in a swimming pool, and I have 120 pages to describe a girl who swim, and I love drawing people in movement and people with elegance doing an action, in his books I took a lot of time to just watch her make some swim in the swimming pool, and the study of animation helped me a lot, and my love for the cinema we see that in this book, that my storyboard, you know, it's very cinematographic.
Definitely.
Yeah.
How long then did you have to spend at the swimming pool doing sketches before you were comfortable that you could do the book?
No, I just go one time at the
at
the swimming pool, but I have never. It was the first time in 24 years that I go to the swimming pool at Paris. When I was young,
yeah.
I go, but I have stopped. I stopped it, and when I return to the swimming pool, I rediscover all of this thing, and it stay in my memory very strong, and I begin to draw the characters swimming. But I look some video of professional swimmers to just watch how they do. But in a moment, you can see that swimming is like running. It's just to put an arms and legs in diagonal. Enfin, it's there is some system to make them efficacious.
Efficient.
And at a moment in these books that don't very really swim, they just float, they just stay on water and talk and have just relaxing moment.
It's funny that I read this book just after I visited an exhibition on Edward Muybridge in Kingston, and seeing the act of movement broken down to individual sort of segments where you have to imagine what goes on in between. I guess that's something that comics do well. But it's unusual to see in a European comic something that's quite so cinematographic. Mm. Do you think that's unusual for European comics? Because it seems to be quite common, for example, in Japan, but not so much in the West.
Yeah, there is a lot of example in Japan, like Akira or other comics. In France, it's begin because the people who have my age or a little higher have this culture of Japanim and of the culture of animation. And now we go a little forward than the 46 page traditional comics, and now the comics took 100 pages and more, and we have a lot of space to not tell story much longer, but to have space on a page to have some space for the drawings and for the action and all this thing.
And the other aspect of the book that kind of seems obvious from your background in animation is the use of flat colors, which is actually really attractive because so many comics these days have been colored on computer, the kind of metal Herlant kind of like super shaded thing. And actually, I find that quite tedious. And it's nice to see a comic where there's such bold use of large areas of color, because actually it tells the story very efficiently and is very pleasing to the eye.
Oh, thanks. For the color, it's just you have three or four blue and just one yellow for the skin. And if that I want is just to have this little yellow, and we can see just the people, the characters of my book really fast. It's really clear, and we can just read the text and turn the pages. For me, a good book is a good book. You can read it fast, and you don't it's difficult to tell this in English.
What's the French?
On ne se rend pas compte quand on tourne les pages très vite. You don't look that you turn the page really quick and you are in the story. And it's that.
In terms of your work as a whole, is this unusual as one of your projects? Because I had a brief look at one of your black and white graphic novels in the bar downstairs, and that seemed to be much more text heavy. It seemed to be much darker in its use of ink. Is this a departure for you, or is it actually a development of your style?
Yeah, this book it took place in a few days, and on the other book that I made, Paulina. The story of it's a story at the beginning of a girl who have 4 or 5 years old, and at the end has 30 years old.
Okay.
And we make some jump in the story, in the years, and for that I have 200 pages, but sometimes it's a little. I have more text, more characters, but. The thing that I want is that you turn the page really fast. But I know it's a silly thing, but it's really important for me. And in the comics, that you don't remind you it's a book. It's just real characters, and I really appreciate when I talk with people who talk about my characters like they're all alive. It's for me, it's the best compliment.
What was the genesis of this project? Was it based on any kind of personal experience?
No, I'm not a good swimmer. I just go to this swimming pool because, yes, the autobiographic thing, I go to the swimming pool because I have my back give me pain. And there is this girl. This girl exists, but I have met her in another condition, another time. And I realized myself that the swimming pool is the worst place where I can talk to a girl because I'm not a good swimmer, and with the suit, it's I look like nothing, and it's very difficult. And I say, okay, it will be fun to tell a story in the swimming pool.
Mm. Because it's very ambiguous just what her interest in him is. Because the last time we see the girl in the story, she mouths something to him underwater, and then at the risk of spoiling it for people who haven't read it, she then disappears. And it's really kind of wistful. It's all about the idea of the potential of having a relationship, and then you don't know what went wrong.
Yes, I live... This is my life, but I always... seeing there is a potential or something can happen, and in fact no, or maybe it was maybe the most beautiful girl in the college was in love with me, but I don't know. It's this thing that I like, and we can see the people who have read this book say the personages are in love or something, but we don't know nothing about this girl and how she looks the relation. The people say, oh, maybe she has feelings or something, but maybe she go to the swimming pool and she have good relation with a boy, and is this thing that I like. And for make a metaphor of this thing, I make her talking underwater, and we don't understand what is it, and we never know if she had feelings or no, or maybe she say another word.
My French isn't terribly good, but I imagine that if I read this book in French, I'd just about be able to follow it, because actually there isn't that much dialogue in the book. It's all about the movement and the sort of the body language. On the back of anyone who might have enjoyed A Taste of Chlorine in English, are there any other of your books that don't have so much dialogue that perhaps could be an easy introduction to someone whose French has been 20 years since they did GCSE?
Yeah, I made some other book. One called La Boucherie. I don't know in English.
The butcher shop?
Yes. Okay. We talk about relation between men and women. There are not much dialogue, and there is some schema. There is some... there is some strips that there is like in The Taste of Chlorine, and there is other strip more intellectual or more... there is a lot of things in this book. And maybe this one, and I finished a pornographic novel, and I think if you are English, you can understand a lot the the story.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
A Taste of Chlorine is available now from all good bookshops, while the author's French language titles can be imported from such sites as www.amazon.fr. And I'd like to thank the PR team at the Institut Français for setting up my interview with Bastien yesterday evening.
How's it going? This is Kid Koala. You're listening to Panel Borders, Resonance FM 104.4.
I'm Alex Fitch, and I'm in the new Gosh Comics in Berwick Street, which has just moved to this new location from their previous home of opposite the British Museum. And I'm talking to Luke Pearson about his new book, Everything We Miss, published by Nobrow.
It's the second solo title that's been published by Nobrow that's been written and drawn by you. How did this second project come about?
Basically, it was kind of always in the pipeline. We were talking about it as I was doing Hilda Folk. It was kind of agreed that I'd do another book like 6 months after Hilda Folk came out, so I was beginning the ideas while I was working on that, really.
It's a considerably darker piece, though, than Hilda Folk. It's about how just at the edge of our vision there are all sorts of different creatures that either observe or interact with human lives. I mean, I suppose some of that is a metaphorical idea that I guess we've all felt from time to time, that we haven't been fully in control of our lives, that we make decisions or we don't make decisions that have bad consequences, and it'd be nice to be able to blame those on shadowy figures that control humanity. I mean, were those sort of notions the birth of the project?
Yeah, definitely. Well, initially, my initial idea for the project was that the book would be less of a traditional narrative. It was going to be comprised of a series of vignettes, which would be all kind of loosely tied around the idea of things that we miss, things that we physically miss, things we don't see, people missing each other, all that kind of thing, kind of having fun, kind of dark fun, with all the notions that could come with that. Kind of the title was almost the starting point. But this breakup story kind of naturally evolved from it. I realised it wasn't going to be really fulfilling enough to have these kind of just loosely interconnected bits. I knew I wanted some kind of some sort of story strand to come from it, and that just kind of grew naturally from it, and it became what it is that way.
And the length of it, it's kind of, I guess, what would have been called prestige format back in the day, mm-hmm. in terms of traditional comics, with a spine. I mean, it feels more like a graphic novella than, say, some of your previous projects.
Yeah.
Did it just come to a natural length, or did you plot it to come out to a certain number of pages?
That page length was there from the start. Nobrow kind of work with a few kind of like set formats, and this was the same format as The Wolf's Whistle, and I had this page count from the start that was there, so I had that to begin working with before I even really had the idea, but I find that useful. Like most of the other work I've done in the past has been for anthologies and things, and there's always a page count before I have my idea, and that's been the case with basically every comic I've done. But I found that nice, because it means I know exactly the kind of story I can tell. And a lot of the things I've done, like one of my aims has been to push like how much I can get out of a short space, like page space. I did the Stool Pigeon comics a couple of years ago, and they were just one page, and that was a really sort of interesting challenge for me, and really kind of affected the way I work now, I think. Trying to cram as many sort of narrative ups and downs into one small space as possible. I mean, this comic's the longest one I've ever done, even though it's still quite short. It's not a graphic novel, even though it kind of feels like one, maybe because of the subject matter.
And combining a fairly dark story about the breakup of a relationship and little vignettes of what are happening to people around the main couple that the story's about, when it came to inserting the fantastical creatures into that narrative, was that something that it was quite easy to do, the way that in the story itself they kind of insinuate themselves into the narrative?
Yeah. Well, with a lot of the things, like the idea of them was to sort of give a physical presence to the kind of anxieties and insecurities, the kind of dark, unpleasant feelings that are kind of floating around when breakups are happening, and other sort of unpleasant things. That was kind of the idea. A lot of them kind of grew naturally. Those little guys, the anurids, the kind of eight-legged frog spider creatures who are always out of sight, like they're always there but you can't see them, like they were some thing that I had a dream about years ago, and I kind of wrote down in my sketchbook, and they became an obvious, I suddenly realised they were an obvious thing, they fit into the story, and they just became part of it. Like the story didn't evolve, I didn't write it start to finish, it was kind of, and you had an end in mind, had a start in mind, and like the other stuff was kind of built up from the middle, it all kind of bubbled out of something. But there was always room to kind of drop more things in and then weave the story around those.
Because your previous project, Hilda Folk, is suggested by and inspired by Northern European mythology, and I guess is a lighter take on the kind of mysterious creatures that you might find out in the woods. Are there any particular branches of folk tales and mythology that inspire you when it comes to doing fantastical tales?
Well, I'm really interested in, I think my favourite ones have always been kind of Norse folklore, elves and trolls, Guardians and like Giants. They're my favourites. Things that live out in the wilderness. Things that are kind of big but somehow go unseen. I've always found that interesting. Like it's, I guess it's kind of just a childish interest in monsters where that is what it stems from. I'm always trying to come up with ways to justify putting them in my comics. I think a lot of the time there's things I like to draw. Yeah.
And then coming up with a narrative that is both cinematic in its storytelling and has elements of graphic design, I guess that becomes, that comes from all sorts of different influences on both your life and your work. I guess visits to the cinema, for example, the opening page of Everything We Miss, where you see the landscape illuminated by a passing car, and then other pages where you have to turn the page sideways in order to read the text and then back again. That sort of oscillation between filmic techniques and graphic design, do you find that actually makes it easier to tell a story because you know you have all these different artistic styles at your fingertips?
Yeah. I mean, I feel quite free when I'm making a comic. I never set myself too many rules as to kind of like my page layouts. Like, I'm quite happy to throw a bit in where you have to turn the page on its side, even if that doesn't happen elsewhere in the book. Yeah, it's not something I really consider too much. It just all seems to happen quite naturally. I mean, those things, I don't know where they come from sometimes. I plan out my pages quite thoroughly. I'm always looking for an interesting page layout, something that's distinctive or maybe unusual. I'm kind of trying more recently to tone it down because I kind of felt early on I was doing that just to kind of showboat, really. Just doing it for the sake of it, just throwing in kind of symmetry and patterns and crazy panel structures just because I can. And I think you can do some interesting things with that. But with Everything We Miss, really, I was kind of reining myself in a bit. There is a more structured to how I've done them. But I like throwing in kind of cinematic techniques. And not so much cinematic angles. I try to keep everything kind of straight on because I find that works best from a cartooning point of view. But lighting was a thing that I was considering quite a lot in Everything We Miss.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Luke Pearson's graphic novella Everything We Miss and shorter comic Hilda Folk are available now from Nobrow Press and in all good comic shops, including the aforementioned Gosh Comics in Soho. Speaking of Gosh, Canadian cartoonist Anders Nilsson will be signing in Berwick Street at 6 p.m. on Saturday the 15th of October as part of a UK tour that sees him visit Page 45 in Nottingham on Sunday the 16th and OK Comics in Leeds on Monday the 17th. He then gets a day off before coming back to London to do a Q&A at Orbital Comics on Wednesday the 19th of October, where he'll be chatting to British cartoonist Tom Gould. Also at Orbital Comics on Great Newport Street in London on Sunday the 29th of October, Mike and Laura Allred will be doing a signing of their work, including the pop art classics Madman and Ecstatics. Then, on Thursday, November the 3rd, at the impossibly fashionable bar Jaguar Shoes, 32 Kingsland Road, Shoreditch, the publishers of Luke Pearson's books, Nobrow Press, will be launching their new anthology from 6:30 p.m. More info about events at Gosh can be found at www.goshlondon.com, while the Anders Nilsson Q&A at Orbital and the Nobrow relaunch can be found at www.comicafestival.com. Panel Borders was recorded, introduced and edited by Alex Fitch, and you can find an extended version of tonight's show and all previous episodes on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com, with the next episode back on air next Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.